The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. David McIlvaney, finally back. You've been gone a long time. I've been interviewing you by phone now for, I think, 3 weeks. You're back from Europe. You talked to Frank Biancari last week, and we've gotten a lot of comments on the program. But he does have a pretty strong French accent. So if a listener has a hard time understanding any of our interviews, we would direct them to the transcripts, wouldn't we?
Yeah, we do that every week. And just as sort of an added service, some people like to read versus listen.
Right.
And that way you can kind of pick it up and come back to it when you want to.
And you can check us for errors.
Well, of course.
Yeah.
Of course, the style is more conversational, and so it reads in a unique way.
Let me ask you a question, Dave, because last week's commentary, when we were talking to Frank Biancari, we were getting a completely different insight than we're getting from the London news or the U.S. news. You do have a group of people in Europe right now who are seeing this crisis as an opportunity, sort of that Chinese character that crisis can also be interpreted as opportunity. Is that opportunity for Americans?
No, really, it's not. It's an opportunity for Europeans, and it is a good opportunity. And I think one of the conclusions that he comes to, and I don't know that it's going to be as easy a journey, there's nothing a fait accompli in 2015 or 2016, but what is moving that direction is greater integration fiscally, greater integration politically, and as he suggested last week, crisis compresses time. That said, it's a critical, critical idea that our listeners should wrap their minds around crisis time.
Means things can really rapidly change. Now, something that's been on my mind since I heard the interview was he talked about a transnational referendum that would overwhelmingly pass, he says, from nation to nation to nation, versus what we saw with the Maastricht Treaty or some of these other treaties where they had to be passed by Greece or Germany or Spain. But I guess the question that I have in my mind is, there's really no ruling governing body that could pull that off right now. Is there a void that's being created that this crisis might bring about?
Well, and I guess that is the real question, is how do they move forward fiscally? How do they move forward politically,
right,
when you still have the mechanisms in place to be nationally oriented, not on a broader sort of pan-European cooperative basis running things, whether it is financially or politically? So I think one of the things that he does point out very well, and we reflect on it this week as well, there is a banking problem.
Yeah.
And there is a debt crisis. But that is not to say that the European Union is dead or that the euro as a currency is dead. And I think this is a critical distinction to make, because oftentimes we here in the U.S. will like to say they're all lumped in together.
Right.
If one is impaired, the other goes too. So, you know, the surest bet in the world is to bet against the euro, as in the monetary unit. And I would disagree with that strongly.
Sure.
Partially because you have support from China, partially because you have support from the G20, partially because you have a huge invested interest from the most powerful elite in Europe in seeing the euro succeed in whatever form it ultimately takes.
Well, and partially because the United States does not have a currency that necessarily offers a really grand alternative.
Kevin, we've talked about paradigm shifts in the past, and Thomas Kuhn's book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions,
right,
is sort of the best discussion of how that happens amongst academics. And one of the things that he makes very clear is that you have to have a substitute model for the old model to be cast out. What is the new idea? This is one of the ridiculous things with the Wall Street protests currently taking place.
Yeah, everybody's mad, but what are they about?
And is there an alternative solution? I mean, are we talking about an environmental concern, better green than greed? I mean, we've seen so many different placards that what exactly is this about? It's not really clear. And furthermore, do they offer an alternative solution? If you have a problem, what's the solution? Now, backtrack. With the currency system, we've defined the problem. Not
right,
you and I, but there is a growing global consensus.
Well, the markets are defining the problem.
Exactly,
yeah.
And that problem is dollar monopoly reserve status.
Sure.
So if that is the problem, then you have to have an alternative. And so you do catch this strong bid for the euro, specifically the monetary unit, as the operative alternative or supplement to the dollar monopoly system.
Did you catch a little resentment in the voice of Frank Minicari when he was talking about the established old world order that was established in 1945 with Bretton Woods, and then actually that we reneged on when we took ourselves off the gold standard completely in 1971? You know, I think the rest of the world has a little bit of a resentment to the fact that we had guaranteed them a reserve currency, which was a guarantee in gold, that has been pretty much reneged.
And I think this is something that's pretty critical, Kevin, because from Bretton Woods forward, there was a trade-off with that. We were the world's reserve currency, but we also gave them, the rest of the world, access to U.S. markets.
Right.
And a part of what has made this system work is a system of trade imbalance where they run surpluses, we run deficits, and it seems to work pretty well. It's a complete recalibration post-Bretton Woods to trade off this deficit-surplus exchange and the recycling of those surplus dollars into treasury, something we've done for decades, into a new system altogether. And this is where I think we run a great risk. We talked about this a little bit in our Friday comments and our wealth management website. The Chinese currency bill that is in front of our legislators this week.
Right. Blame the Chinese because they're the ones who are doing this to us.
They're manipulating their currency lower.
Right.
You know, implicit in that is a real problem, Kevin, because if we take the currency, the Chinese currency, and raise it or force them to raise it beyond, a normal orderly pace, guess what happens?
Right.
One of our primary trade partners all of a sudden sees a diminishing trade surplus, and that diminishing trade surplus, those dollars which were going to be available to buy treasuries, all of a sudden are no longer available because they don't exist anymore. So it's in the category of be careful what you wish for, because on the one hand, we want to bring about greater global financial stability. That's the guise that this bill is under, and if these guys would just stop manipulating their currency, that's how some of our legislators have cast this, we may in fact find that we are sinking the treasury market in order to create a greater sense of fairness in the world. How ironic would that be that we get disaster while trying to bring about stability?
David, the light really went off for me a year and a half or 2 years ago when we interviewed Paul Craig Roberts, and he just simply said this. This is how our economy is built. We basically deficit spend with foreigners, and China being one of the greatest ones of all. Yeah, let's say $400 billion worth of a trade deficit. Well, that means they have $400 billion more of our currency than we got of theirs. And then they turn around and buy our treasury bills. That allows us to borrow money for the next year. And, he brought it out that, gosh, things have changed a little bit. It's no longer a $400 billion trade deficit to where it's equalizing out. We're now, $1.6, $1.7 trillion. There's not enough money, even if we keep these trade partners out there, there's not enough money to continue to fund the debt that we have.
Kevin, we've long said that the Chinese did not buy our treasuries as an investment, but really for political reasons.
Right.
And it is interesting that there were certain foreign governments that this last week sold $66.6 billion of U.S. treasuries. So that's from August 31st till today. And this is what's interesting, because if you look at a chart of the U.S. treasuries, you see something that has gone up and up and up and up and up in price. And there is, for someone, maybe it's a sovereign wealth fund with a slightly different mandate, there is the investment motive, not simply a political purchase in the treasury market. So, yeah, $66.6 billion of liquidations by foreign entities since August 31st. And if you look at the chart, and that's what I'm saying, look at the chart, it makes all the sense in the world. You are selling at record prices. Treasuries have never been this high, and yet the market consensus is we need to be moving out of equities and into bonds because bonds are a safe haven asset.
David, I think you've mentioned here recently that there is a misunderstanding or a miscalculation with this move into the dollar and the move into treasuries. And that miscalculation is that people right now are moving towards liquidity, but they're ignoring solvency. So in other words, they're getting into something that they feel is liquid because it's cash or treasuries or what have you. But there's a solvency issue, just like we see in Europe.
Well, and this is the danger of logic, because they're buying on a logical basis.
Right.
They're buying treasuries because it makes sense to buy treasuries. But consider this, they may be asking the wrong question altogether. And that's the problem. If they're buying on the basis of liquidity concerns, when in fact liquidity is not the issue, but solvency is the issue.
Right. Pay your debt.
They bought logically treasuries, but with a very faulty premise. That wasn't the issue to begin with. And I think, Kevin, what we've seen, and this was a very interesting insight, Frank Minicari, last week, is that the Western media, the Anglo-Saxon media, has something to gain, considerable gains to maintain. by casting the euro problem, Kevin, as something that is just disastrous. And so, you know, you don't want to buy European bonds, you want to buy U.S. treasuries instead.
Well, yeah.
There's now a gross competition for limited resources, and we really want to see those cash flows coming to us.
David, I'd like to shift gears here. We've asked our listeners to send in questions, and they've definitely done so. And we'd ask again if they would continue to send questions, because we treat the fall as a period of time where we open up the discussion to our clients and to our listeners and say, hey, is there something that you would like David's insight on, and or another guest's even? So, David, the email that a person should use to send those questions.
If you want to send those to McIlvaney, it's McIlvaney at McIlvaney.com. Keep it simple.
Pretty simple.
McIlvaney at McIlvaney.com.
All right. Well, I'm going to go to one of the questions that a client has sent in, because I think it brings up a great discussion. This was a letter that came in a couple of weeks ago. It says, here's the question for the Q&A podcast. He says, all the experts say that spending cannot be allowed to fall. If it does, then the vicious cycle starts. Businesses don't have much business, so they lay off workers. And that means there are more unemployed, which means less spending, which leads to less income for businesses, etc., etc., etc. And supposedly, we will continue to spiral downward until we get back, really, to the Stone Age, this guy says. What would be the Austrian rebuttal to this scenario? Obviously, we haven't always had governments to prop up spending. In history, there have been downward spirals, but they've been temporary. Something eventually halts and then reverses the downward spiral. What is that something? That's a great question, because we're told by the Keynesians that they have to come in and print money. But when they didn't do that, what stopped the spiral, Dave?
Well, I think just to give a preview, I think price is the ultimate something that stops the downward spiral. The Austrian response would point to the importance of savings and investment for there to be sustainable economic growth and wealth creation. This is, I guess, something that we can ask anyone we work with or live with, and this is very practical. Does an individual grow wealthier by spending every dollar they earn? Because that's essentially what the non-Austrians or what the Keynesians would suggest. We will create wealth by spending every dollar we have.
Right.
In fact, we can even create more wealth if we spend money we don't have. And that to us is a little bit backwards. We think that wealth is a product of thrift and thoughtful investment, whether that's in ideas or enterprises that multiply access to higher quality or even greater quantities of goods, Kevin. And, you know, again, if you start with thrift and then look at thoughtful investment, that's different than you make it, you spend it.
Right.
What do you do next?
Well, the Keynesians have given us this incredible fear, David, of this word called deflation. Okay, now the definition of deflation, simply, you can define it a number of ways, but let's just figure that deflation means that your money, whatever the money is, buys more things versus inflation, which is your money buys
less things.
Right.
Or the other side of that is those things are more expensive.
So tell me, why is it that I should fear my money buying more things?
Well, this is actually, Kevin, if you look at Great Britain, if you look at America, we've had periods of deflation which have been hugely productive and actually, in terms of economic growth, the best periods in time, because you had relatively constant incomes with declining prices, which means that for the guy who's on a fixed income or for a gal who's making X amount per year, it gets to buy more and more each year versus less and less each year.
Dave, could you imagine actually going to the store every year and things costing just a little bit less? We've never had that in our lifetime.
Well, but if you're seeing innovation, if you're seeing productivity gains, you should to some degree see that happen. I mean, let's just choose something maybe on the outside here, but you know, your iPhone used to cost $500-$600, and now you can buy the old model, of course, but because there's new models that have come out, you can buy it for about half that much.
Right, right.
Now, I mean, I like the iPhone. I don't have one. I hate my BlackBerry. I have a hate relationship with my BlackBerry.
Nah.
But so there is a transition ahead for me to becoming a fully Apple-centric person. But this is the issue. It's getting cheaper and cheaper by the day. We've seen technology progress, and productivity has enabled the distribution of a fantastic product
things
at cheaper prices.
Things should cost less.
And again, Kevin, that's just an issue of a price declining to the point where I'm compelled to buy. And that's why, going back to that question, what is the something that stops this spiral? Kevin, if you came to me and said, I'd like to sell you my house for $1 million, I said, well, I already have a house. I'm really not in the market.
Right.
But if you came to me and said instead, David, I need to sell my house. I'd like to sell it for $50,000. I just need something. I need some cash now.
And the house should be worth, say, $800,000, $900,000, $1 million, whatever it is.
I'm going to at least stop and think to myself, while I don't need it, the price is compelling. And I may give you some of my money for your house. I mean, and again, I'm not suggesting, you know, anything. You're not in financial straits. You know, this is, but if someone, it becomes compelling when the price is the right price. Now, right. What is the right price? That really is determined by the business cycle. Things get expensive and things get cheap. And if you are buying low and selling high, that's how you make money.
Sure.
If you're buying high and selling low, that's how you lose money. And there is a need for the business cycle where there is something almost of a regenerative nature. You know, in amongst the big business community, you have good ideas and bad ideas.
Right.
Without the business cycle, bad ideas get to live on, and good ideas sometimes can't compete, because by the time those bad ideas, should they in fact be subsidized through government spending or you know Fed liquidity creation or things like that, then guess what? The good businesses end up being constrained and can in fact fail where the bad businesses succeed. And how does that really help business? How does that really help the economy? How does that really help employment? In fact, it doesn't.
Right. Okay, Dave, I'd like to play just a little bit of a thought experiment with you. Okay, let's pretend like we didn't go off the gold standard and the dollar actually just maintained value. And as we became more efficient and as transportation and production became more efficient, prices actually came down. That's that dreaded deflation that I think the Federal Reserve wants you to fear. If that was the case, okay, and you were a savvy businessman, you would go through expansion. You probably, if you were careful, you wouldn't go into too much debt, you wouldn't overexpand, you'd save some, so that when things begin to fall, you could go in and actually, you were talking about this guy, maybe me, who needed to sell the house for $50,000. Well, there's a reason I needed to sell the house for $50,000. I need that. I'm not being forced to do it. I need the $50,000. You can go ahead and pick up the house at a good buy. Now, what happens is, that stops the spiral of the business cycle, because then, like you said,
savings come out of the woodwork and get deployed into something more productive than just sitting on the side.
And, you know, I'm not Darwinian by any means, but it is an evolutionary type of thing where the good ideas actually accumulate more and more assets and produce better ideas down the road.
Right. Well, you know, the two steps forward, what we're really talking about, Kevin, is the dreaded one step back.
Right.
In that, if you can avoid progress the normal way, what we would see is two steps forward, one step back. Over a longer period of time, there is progress made.
Right.
That's not to say it's without pain. This is something that I think we all recognize, again, just in the way we live our lives.
Right.
Relationships progress and mature, and they're not always easy. Sometimes it's champagne, and sometimes it's just getting by on bread and water. I mean, in terms of an emotional experience in relationship with someone, there's sometimes reason to celebrate, and sometimes just it's really not fun.
Right.
I think you have those same sort of ebbs and flows in all of life. The market is not any different. But to go from champagne experience to champagne experience to champagne experience and to believe that that is real,
right,
that is what life is about, that is, in fact, what the Fed holds to in terms of their original mandates.
It produces malnutrition and hangovers. Is really going for, you know, for, okay, now
you're more right about that than you know. You're spot on. That is exactly what we're talking about. Hangovers, which are far more severe than you would ever expect,
right,
and malnutrition, because in fact assets are misallocated and you don't have healthy growth. You have a very unhealthy and a very skewed economy.
Once again, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. And just a reminder, we have had a slew of questions sent in, but if there's something that we have not covered or you would like us to cover, send that to McIlvaney@McIlvaney.com, and we'll try to cover that question. And if you can get those questions in the next week or two, that would help us. Okay, now, we've been talking as far as a broad economy, and I sometimes feel like, even I have it, a victim mentality, where I'm like, well, these darn Keynesians, they've been winning since the 1930s. They've been ruining my money. They've been taking this away. I have no defense against this. But, David, we were talking last night and thinking about it, and let's talk about deflation as maybe it's been actually happening over the last 10 years or so. You know, we see people who are writing newsletters and talking on TV and saying, beware of gold, because if we have a deflation, you're really going to lose money. And there's a misunderstanding there. They're treating gold like it's a commodity, like it's one of these other things, when in reality, for the last 4,000 years, gold really has been the underlying form of money. Now, just looking at this, when a person calls and says, hey, do you think we'll have deflation? My thought is, in reality, with money being what we just said it was gold. We've had deflation for the last 10 years. Yeah, take the price of a house.
Take the price of a house. Take the value of the stock market. I mean, you have seen your purchasing power in money terms, what we're calling gold terms or gold money terms.
Right.
Kevin, your purchasing power has gone up many fold.
So, David, let's just take a house 10 years ago. Let's say it was a nice house 10 years ago, $300,000. Okay, at $300 gold, that's 1,000 ounces of gold. That same house today, even if it's risen in dollar value a little bit, can be purchased for between 200 and 300 ounces.
Kevin, what you're talking about is your money, your savings held in gold, now purchases 5 times what it used to.
Right.
I mean, that is an indication of deflation. Other assets relative to cash, what we would call cash, gold bullion, your cash now buys 5 times what it did. In equities, it's even more dramatic. The overvaluation coming into 2000, 2001
right.
now puts you at a purchasing power of between 12 and 15 times today.
That's in stocks.
What it was in 2000, 2001. So the dreaded deflation has been happening, and it's
yes.
been to the advantage, not of the cash holder, not as in the greenback holder,
right.
but to the gold holder. So I think what people often forget is that gold as money does very well in a deflation. And we're not just talking about the last 10 years, but if you wanted to go back into British history, this is the case. More often than not, gold does better during a deflation than it does during an inflation. The only exception to that is radical inflations, wherein the repricing is instant, like a hyperinflation,
yeah.
and then gold is something of a protective measure. But in terms of a slow bleed, 2, 3, 4, 5%, gold is actually much better in a deflation than an inflation.
Which is what we've been seeing. Reminds me of a Gary Larson cartoon, okay? Because I'm thinking, we don't have to be victims here, okay? Just let the Keynesians do what they want. Let them print money. But I'm going to go ahead and take that printed money, and I'm going to buy gold, at least for now. And I'm going to put it in the base of the triangle, and I'm going to let myself enjoy the true business cycle. And the Gary Larson cartoon I'm thinking of, I'm sure a lot of people have seen it. Gary Larson is the guy who does Farsight. And it's a picture of thousands and thousands of sheep, you know, just standing out in a pasture. And one of them is standing up with his arms wide open. And he goes, wait a second. We don't all have to be sheep anymore.
When you look at what has happened in terms of deflation, the two areas where you've seen the greatest contraction relative to money, our benchmark for money is gold,
right.
equities and real estate, where you saw the greatest benefit in terms of credit expansion over the last 30 years, equities and real estate. So corporate America was supercharged on a dope served up by the Federal Reserve, as was the real estate market. Now, where have you seen the greatest hangover?
Right.
Equities and real estate. So where will we continue to see the greatest quote-unquote deleveraging?
Equities
and real estate.
But, okay, with that said, you have continually talked about an exit strategy, and we're not really talking about necessarily exiting gold. We always recommend a third. But if we are to employ the business cycle, just like this listener had asked about, there will be a bottoming of this. And you've talked about the ratio to equities when it may be wise to start taking some of your gold profit and going into equities. Would you recount that again?
Well, Kevin, this is the benefit of a stressful period in time. It really tests the strength of a business model. And there are some businesses that make it through stressful periods of time and do very well on the other side. And there's other businesses that were not organized well, that had bad leadership, bad
sure.
business plans, bad products. And guess what happens to them?
They go
the way of the dodo bird.
Unless the government funds them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then you have Solyndra's and all kinds of other businesses which do quite well on the back of taxpayers, not on the basis of a clear business plan.
Right.
So that's the case, Kevin, where stress in the marketplace is actually very good for helping an investor refine where they should invest their capital productively. It's only in the context of stress, only in the context of the bottoming of a business cycle, where an investor can say, now we understand the landscape. Now we can see who, under stress, has survived and does very well. I would like to reallocate my savings in whatever form that is, and for us that is gold, into something productive.
Right.
And I see that the field has now been cleared. We know who the clear leaders are. We know where we should be investing capital.
Now, you're still thinking ahead. I mean, you're
talking
maybe 2-4 years down the road.
Exactly. Yeah. But I mean, we're seeing that process unfold, Kevin, where, yes, today your purchasing power is 12 to 15 times what it was 10 years ago,
right,
the gold owner versus the equities owner. But that cycle will take us to a 20, 30, even 40 times purchasing power when all is said and done.
Isn't that amazing? And that is a cycle. That Dow-gold ratio is a cycle. You can go back and look to all the way to 1896 when they started measuring the Dow.
And that, again, is just sort of the agnostic view of investing, where it doesn't matter whether you're in gold or in equities. What matters is that you do have a sound understanding of what money is,
right,
because your money needs to be there when you need it to be there. And that's the point. To reallocate from one to the other assumes that you have maintained your value while the rest of the world has been compressed.
Well,
and it's normal for this compression to occur. Again, two steps forward, one step back.
You know, I think about Al Siebert's book, The Survivor Personality. He's a military psychologist, and he went and interviewed people who had survived incredible hardships, whether they were military or Holocaust or some sort of concentration camp oriented. And what he said was interesting, Dave. He said, you don't want to be or think in nouns. In other words, you don't want to think, well, I'm a doctor and that's all I do. Or same thing with investments. Well, I own gold. I'm a gold buyer. He says, you want to be a verb. You've got to be able to be flexible, even to the point of healthy schizophrenia. And I think about the triangle. For years, we've not recommended 100% in gold. We've not recommended 100% in equities or cash. We've recommended a third, a third, a third. And sometimes that third, like the gold third at this point, just like stocks in the 90s, that third has grown to much more than a third of a lot of our clients' portfolios. But there's a time to reallocate. Here's this healthy schizophrenia. You don't fall in love. You don't fall in love with any of the sides and just go exclusive with that, do you?
No, you don't. And that's what allows you to view wealth on an intergenerational basis, to look at investing as a legacy project,
right,
wherein you can give the skills to any generation to look and say, listen, things change. We know that. Things change, and you have to adapt to change. There are new ideas that will emerge. There are new companies that will emerge that should be considered. There are new leaders that will emerge that will either hurt or help you. And we're not here to derive an investment thesis on the basis of our political views or any other views. Just understand that things change, and at some times you will have wind in your sails. And at other times, you will be just focused on survival.
Right.
And we're talking of survival of an economic or financial nature. This is, again, those periods of compression that you would like to avoid if you can, or expansion, which you'd like to take advantage of if you can. The question is, what causes those periods of expansion to occur? We've had credit growth for 30 to 40 years. Now we have credit contraction. We've had it for 10. We'll probably have it for another 10. Maybe it's shorter than that, and it's only 5 to 7 year contraction from this point forward. But the reality is there is a tremendous amount of debt overhang.
Right.
The U.S. economy is leveraged roughly 20 to 1, $53 trillion in debt, $3 trillion in equivalent assets. That, if you look at our money system, not the whole economy, but just our money system, that's a high degree of leverage.
Yeah.
There's going to be winners and losers in this game. The losers are going to be the ones that are overexposed and hold assets that are still in the midst of compression. And the winners are going to be the ones that have cash. And again, let me define cash. If you still have confidence in greenbacks, if you still have confidence in the treasury market, you are making the judgment that liquidity is now and in the future the primary issue to be concerned with. And I would caution you to stop and reevaluate completely, because liquidity is a concern that comes and goes in a matter of days or weeks. Solvency is something that stays with you for weeks, months, years, or decades. And that is the issue we have in front of us as a country. That is the issue that we face, and the concern that many of the deflationists have. We still have an unwind of a massive amount of debt. That will occur. It has to occur. This is what happens in this kind of business environment. But does that mean you go to the worst bet in terms of solvency on the basis of trying to solve a liquidity problem? Does this make sense, Kevin?
Well, you know, I'm just thinking the rumors of the fat lady singing on this recession and this deleveraging are far overstated. The fat lady has not sung.
No, in fact, what we see in Europe, we see playing out here in the United States. It's just a matter of months before it begins to cascade here on this side of the pond. It's not out of the realm of possibility that we'll see the stock market crater over the next few months. And, you know, there's characteristics in the fall of 2008 which are being mimicked now.
Right.
Very uncertain. The earnings environment is fading quickly. There's a number of things which are unsupportive, you know, in terms of the business environment. Now, what about the larger financial picture? Larger financial picture is as ugly as it's ever been. Kevin, this is a case in point. We've talked about Dexia. Dexia has now been nationalized.
You were at Dexia. In fact, we had an account with Dexia, didn't we, a few years ago?
Sure. Know when to hold them, know when to fold them.
Yeah.
Know when to walk away, know when to run.
Well, explain to the listener who Dexia is.
Well, Dexia is one of the larger Belgian banks and Belgian-French concerns doing business in both countries. Now it's largely owned by both countries, as in the governments have had to take over the bank. Kevin, what we pointed out in last week's comments was that Dexia was truly on life support, but when the stress tests were applied this last summer, they came out smelling like a rose. There was no problem at all apparent according to the stress tests.
Huh.
Same thing is happening, Kevin, right now with an Austrian bank, one of the largest. The Erste Group is now reporting billions in exposure, credit default swap exposure, and major losses, as much as $460 million immediate losses, but they're looking at several billion dollars in losses given their credit default swap exposure. What's interesting is that they, too, went through the European stress test, and in the context of the stress test, nothing of their CDS exposure was revealed. Nothing at all.
This is really scary. I mean, history does rhyme. It may not repeat itself exactly, but you're talking about an Austrian bank that was a little bit overrated until it wasn't. And if you go back to the early 1930s, Dave, I think we had the same thing happen
at Anstalt.
Yeah.
This is the unique thing, Kevin. We're trying to create confidence in the marketplace by creating these sham tests, saying,
right,
look at our measure. By our measure, everything is fine and healthy here. Kevin, if your tests are not legitimately rigorous enough to prove out who are the good bets and bad bets, if your effort is really just to save everyone,
right,
again, sort of taking away from that business cyclicality where the good banks are going to succeed and
yeah,
the bad banks are going to fail, and the good banks will then come in and buy the assets of the bad bank, and they'll be that much stronger of an entity moving forward.
It's like a medical diagnosis. If you go in to get your physical, you don't want the doctor to tell you you're fine if you're not fine.
You're doing just fine. Your liver just failed. You're doing just fine. You know, this is the issue, Kevin.
Yeah.
They set up a sham test and now have lost credibility, even more credibility, because the market gets to say, wait a minute, Dexia, you lied. Erste Group, you lied. Well, should we have the same appraisal that we do, in fact, trust you as it pertains to other institutions across Italy and France and Germany and Portugal?
Maybe all institutions.
And that's the issue. That's
yeah,
the issue, Kevin, is we're losing credibility in the marketplace. This, too, is a part of the cycle. A breaking down of trust until the point where no one has confidence anymore, and the few assets that remain are available very inexpensively, if you have preserved value, if you have the ability to redeploy from a cash bullion position and move into the companies that survive and will thrive during the next business cycle upturn. That may be 4 to 5 years hence, but the proper planning still has to take place today.
So let's conclude with this, Dave. We've had a lot of people calling and saying, gosh, gold has been awfully volatile over the last 3 or 4 weeks. And early part of August, gold was in the 1600s. And then all of a sudden it went 17, 18, 19, and then fell right back down into the 16s. So it got ahead of itself probably, but you made a comment to all of us, and I think you probably ought to repeat it to the listeners. The question was, how much further can gold go down? How much further can gold go up in the short run? And what are the chances of that? And what are the parameters that we should be looking for from a dollar price range in gold right now, Dave?
Well, I think just for perspective, I think the listener needs to remember that the gold price has collapsed in the last month. And it's still up 23% from last year.
Yeah, it started the year, what, at 1298?
The press that it's getting, that it's over, the bull market is over, the bubble is burst. Somebody needs to check their facts.
It's the same people who tell us to fear deflation.
We're still up 23% from a year ago this time, Kevin. I think looking at technical analysis, you've got 10% downside on the gold price.
Okay, so 10% down is a possibility.
Hey, with 50% on the upside.
So well, that's a good bet.
It is a good bet. I mean, if you're 50% downside, 50% upside, you're in no man's land.
Right.
You've got equal probabilities of losses.
It's flipping
to being
a coin for a bet.
Exactly. This is 10% downside moving to the 65-week moving average as an outside possibility. I don't count on it. I wouldn't look for it. Our most recent drop to 1531, you were either cotton picking lucky or Well, why were you awake at 1 o'clock in the morning in European trade when it reached 1531 and opened the next day considerably higher? So you may see it go to low numbers, but the reality is you may not capture those lower numbers if you're trying to pick the absolute bottom. That's why I think it's intelligent and mature for an investor to say, I don't have to have the absolute low, I don't have to have the absolute high, but if probabilities are in my favor, 10% on the downside, 50% on the upside,
it's time to buy.
It's time to buy.
Well, and you would also tell our clients not to buy on leverage or debt, because then the volatility does shake the trees and you have to drop it all.
Oh, that's absolutely right. We're talking about physical metals.
Buying at one-on-one.
Exactly, right. Exactly. No leverage. If you're playing leverage in this market, you really don't understand what this market is about. This is an unwind of the Western financial system that's been built over a 50-year period. Mm. And you don't know what all the implications are going to be. What in the world are you doing gambling with leverage? That makes no sense at all. That makes absolutely no sense at all. So for anyone who has a 5-to-1 leverage, 4-to-1 leverage, 3-to-1 leverage, believe it or not, you're the patsy. You may feel like you're the most intelligent guy day trading your account.
Even if it's gold, it's sold. Yeah.
But you're the patsy because you haven't appreciated just how severe the changes are that are coming to the whole financial system. And we were privy to some of those changes in our conversation this last week with Frank Biancheri.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.